Well, returning from the General Conference of Elders was, I felt, very encouraging overall. So many of the men over years are men that I've worked with, either all the way dating back to Pasadena or since in the field, men that I've worked for in different church areas as well. And it's always a real pleasure to be able to visit and catch up a little bit, and also to transact the business of the church in that respect that we do at the General Conference. I want to try to share with you some of what Bob Dick had addressed. Mr. Kylo spoke on the Sabbath, and that was portrayed, played out to all the churches. Much of the church worldwide was actually able to tune in. Bob Dick gave the keynote address, which was during the conference itself. The theme of the conference was going on to perfection. And so he asked, he said, is going on to perfection, is that a platitude or a precept? Now, a platitude, that's not an animal in the Keys, you know, a platitude. A platitude is something that is kind of a high, noble concept, something that's some lofty concept. A precept is what? Well, the precepts of God are his instructions. And so he asked, you know, is it a nice sounding concept going on to perfection, or is it actually something we have to do? Our marching orders, something specific. Are we going on to perfection, he asked, or just going on? You see, part of the strategic planning process the council has been working through is to lay out what it is strategically that we are desiring to accomplish. How do you measure the fact that we're actually doing what we said we wanted to do? That it's not just a matter of throwing literature and throwing money and throwing time and energy into the work, but it's a matter of directing those efforts in a way that will be productive according to God's will. So they're taking the time to quantify what we are trying to accomplish and then to measure if we're truly on our way. Spiritually, for you and me, that process would be, are we going on to perfection, or are we just going on? You can spend your whole life working through the heat of the day, but still not accomplish the task that has been given, our calling in going on to perfection by the power of Jesus Christ. There was also an interesting thing that he said, and I'd like to offer it, because as you heard in the announcement, last year we said we're going to Texas, and this year said, well, not right yet. Let's stop, reassess. Mr. Dick said, obviously, we're not in agreement on that point. Mr. Dick went forward as well at our conference, and he said, the measuring stick to going on to perfection is not amendments or resolutions or council seats. Let's separate the business of the church and administrative matters necessarily from spiritual growth. And I don't mean to say that we could be unspiritual and fulfill administratively God's will, but my point is this. If a person was a carpenter or a plumber, well, you make more money as a plumber. But if you were a carpenter or a plumber, would they not both fulfill possibly God's will in terms of how you could serve in the church? Some of the things that we do administratively, I sat at breakfast with Mr. Bob Barrett, and he was making the distinction between administration is not always specific scriptural principle. Thus saith the Lord. There are a range of choices. The houses that we buy, how big a house we live in, what community we stay and raise our family in, are administrative choices that you and I make but are not necessarily biblically required. They're matters of choice. There are things the church does administratively in that respect as well. So I thought it was interesting, Mr. Dick said, the measuring stick of going on to perfection is not amendments, it is not resolutions, and it is not council seats. So I'd like to keep those in their place. He said the measuring stick of going on to perfection for him was three scriptures that he gave. And I'll read them to you. You'll recognize them. But it's exactly what he gave to us. He said, this is what we're talking about. The other matters we indeed discuss and we make choices. But this is going on to perfection, again, by the power of Jesus Christ. James 1:27. How many times have we heard this? Pure and undefiled religion before God and the Father is this: visit the orphans and widows in their trouble, and to keep yourself unspotted from the world. Come out of her, my people. Keep yourself unspotted from the world and its ways. Mr. Dick said, I turn to this scripture when I want to set my perspective. Psalm 15. He said he goes and reads Psalm 15 as well. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell on your holy hill? He who walks uprightly, works righteousness, not just understands it, does it, applies it, lives it in the family, in the congregation, in our community, speaks the truth in his heart. You know, you can speak it on your lips, but do you believe it? Do you exemplify it? Can I say, does it come out of your pores, the truth? He who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up a reproach against a friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. You make a commitment and you keep it no matter what. We've made a commitment to God, many of us at baptism. Some of us are getting ready to make a commitment to God in that same way. Our children are being raised in order to make such a commitment one day. And it says, and does not change. He who does not put out his money at usury, he who does not take a bribe against the innocent. This is spiritual maturity. It is not amendments or resolutions or council seats. If we really want to get together and agree on something, let's agree on this. I have a very, very dear friend in the ministry. We've been in college together. We've gone in the ministry together. We work in programs together. And frankly, administratively, we are on opposite sides of the coin. Administratively, we are the best of friends. We have never been offensive to each other, as far as I know, in any way. I work for him, he would work for me, and the task would hopefully be done. It has never come between us that we have a disagreement or a difference in terms of administration or perspective in those ways, because he has even said to me, even recently, he said, we agree on the greater things. We agree on the foundation of what God says. These other matters are optional choices. We agree on God's word. Mr. Dick turned to Job 29. The book of Job, at least at this point, is Job's defense against the accusations that were being made against him, and his defense against the fact that he should not have to suffer as he was. But Job 29 and verse number 12, still what he says was true in the sense that these were things that he did. This was how he lived his life. He said, chapter 29, verse 12, he said, I delivered the poor who cried out, and the fatherless, and he who had no helper. The blessing of a perishing man came on me, and I caused the widow's heart to sing for joy. I put on righteousness, and it clothed me. My justice was like a robe and a turban. I was eyes to the blind. I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the poor. And I searched out the case that I did not know. I broke the fangs of the wicked, and I plucked the victim from his teeth. I've often thought if I could measure up to where Job started, I'd be doing well. Man, imagine that God would work us through to the point that he finished. But what a price we might have to pay. That's going on to perfection. Mr. Dick was trying to exemplify and show that this is what we agree on. On the other things, we can certainly have discussion. One thing that too made an imprint on me in the course of it, I noticed at the very last of the last meeting, when the final announcements had been made and we were in a room together and it had been set up with wires and cables, much like this with speakers, and when it was over, Doug Horchek was out there rolling up the cables and taking off the tape and putting it away and packing off some of the equipment. You know, Doug Horchek was ready to be seated on the council, and this time he obviously wasn't. He has served on the council before. He's worked in the youth programs. He runs the youth corps with David Baker, and they serve together in many ways. And yet, here he is, picking up the cables, putting away things. Larry Salyer was walking around. Different times I saw him in the conference carrying boxes, hauling things out, putting things away. Men that could have served in specific ways, General Conference chose, for one reason or another, to not use them in that way at this day, because they have in other times, and they may well again in the future. But they were putting up and taking down and putting away. Dari in Nigeria had mentioned that they had a sing-along book in years past, probably dating all the way back to the Worldwide Church of God. I remember we had one in college, sing-along, and we would use it and have great times. And they wanted to gather some of the music together and get those songs sung and recorded by somebody with a band or a group so they could listen to them and use them for their backups. And he'd mentioned it when Michelle was there, and Michelle was going to try to find it. She'd asked Mr. Salyer if he could help, and he was excited, and he was going to get a group together and record these things. And he came up to me a couple times, again, during the conference. I really want to get that done. That's a great idea. I'm glad to be able to help, just wanting to lend his shoulder to the wheel. I appreciate the example of those who serve. What is it that we are sowing spiritually? We want to be careful what it is, in that sense, spiritually, that we put in to bear fruit in our lives before God. In the book of Galatians, chapter 6, there's a reference to sowing. And verse number 6, it contrasts sowing in a way that goes to waste from sowing in a way that bears much fruit. Again, you go back to the strategic plan. Are we going on to maturity or just going on? Are we productive or are we just busy? I would have to imagine, if we asked, almost everybody's life in this room is pretty full. Full of something, duties, obligations, time, energy, full of things. Okay, but is it full of the things that are productive and fruitful is what we would ask to ask ourselves. Spiritually, that's where we must be. Galatians 6, 6. Let him who is taught the word share in all good things with him who teaches. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. Whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. But we want to reap the good things. He who sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. What's corruption? Well, corruption means the flesh goes to waste. You die in the flesh. The body decomposes in the flesh. Corruption. It isn't a permanent investment. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life, the kingdom of God. Let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart. Therefore, as we have opportunity, let us do good to all, especially to those who are of the household of faith. Do good. Not just do, not just be busy, but do good. Be directed in a very specific way. Amendments, again, resolutions and council seats are not matters of conscience per se. Putting God first is. We want to bear spiritual fruit. The church obviously has some administrative matters to address. I don't think we would ever deny that. Mr. Dick certainly didn't. But let's not confuse that with spiritual fruit. The attitude that goes with it could easily be bad fruit or lack of fruit or wonderful fruit. where our hearts are and our willingness to serve and work and put one another before ourselves obviously has spiritual implications. But let us not grow weary while doing good. Proverbs 10. Is there harvest going on? Have we not been planting seed for many, many years, maybe decades? Anybody here years ago put out Plain Truth magazines on newsstand subscriptions? Okay, some of us did. I know we did. I mean, I wasn't here then. I was somewhere else. And didn't we not put out Good News magazines into the waiting rooms? We had over 1,000. Mert worked with those, and some of you helped her. So we could go back and we could talk about all different kinds of seed that we've planted over decades of time. Well, isn't there, in some respect, also going to be a harvest? So what do we do? Do we lay down in the end when the harvest has been brought to fruition and not go out and labor and continue to reap that which spiritually we have sown? Proverbs 10, verse number 4. He who deals with a slack hand becomes poor, but the hand of the diligent makes one rich. Now, you could look at that physically, but you could look at it spiritually. The hand of the diligent makes one spiritually rich, if it's spiritual diligence. He who gathers in summer is a wise son, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who causes shame. You can look at that physically, or you can look at that spiritually. The harvest is the fruit of the labor and the efforts that have been sown over decades of time. And as that harvest is made available, somebody has to be there to reap. Let us not sleep in harvest. Again, think about it. How many years have we sown? How many different ways? How much investment have we put into young people to teach them and invest in them and excite them and get their attention so that as they grow up one day, you know, they'll go to ABC, they'll go to the Philippines, and then they'll get up here. I say children, Luke is older than that, but he'd get up here and give a sermonette. That's an investment. It's an incredible investment. You know, somebody else made it, not I, but, you know, Christina, we could walk around the room, but it's spiritual fruit. It's a harvest. You don't lay down in the harvest. Megan, going to school in Colorado, Fort Collins. Last Thursday, there were tornadoes in Windsor and Greeley, and I look on the map. Greeley is between Fort Collins and Denver, closer down by the freeway. Her cousin lives in Greeley, and there was a tornado on both sides, about 6 miles on either side of where she was. And Megan was in Fort Collins, and she was, in that morning, didn't feel very good. It was raining a bit, and so she normally goes out to her stables and helps out, cleans up a bit. That's love of horses, if you'll clean up after horses just to be around them. Can you imagine cleaning up after people just to be around them? I mean, I don't know. But that's what she does. But she was going to be there at 11:30. It was a little rainy, so she laid over a couple hours, and the tornado came through at Windsor. Windsor is 6-7 miles outside of Fort Collins. It's on the east side where the stables is. And so Megan is on the phone to me. She's going out. She says, Dad, there was a tornado reported, you know. And she's going out and out of the stables a couple hours late to see what happened. And as she drove into the stables, she's got me on the phone. And some of the shelters for the horses were just completely blown out and over into the next arena area. Fence was down. And tornado didn't hit there, but just the side effects. And, you know, you get to thinking about that. How would you like to sow physically only and reduce your odds to just time and chance? Because that's all you've got. If you're only physically focused, then you take your lot with whatever comes along. Why not just go out to the stables when you were supposed to be there and stand around while the buildings blow away? Well, I don't know. You could say, well, maybe that was just coincidence. Maybe it was. But you know what? I'll take the blessing. I'll take the blessing in terms of God protected us, whether it be you or me or whatever the circumstance was at that moment. but I want to be spiritually invested. Hopefully we all, we want to be spiritually invested. We're not here on the Sabbath because this is some physical good thing to do. We're here because we assemble before God according to His command. I don't want our odds to be reduced to time and chance. 2 Samuel is the story of Ahithophel. When I was in college, we used to talk about if somebody had a bad attitude, we would say, well, now don't get an Ahithophelian attitude, because they had a bad attitude. And if they hadn't studied their Bible, they didn't know what you were saying. They might have thought you were, you know, commending them or something, but it wasn't so. 2 Samuel 16 and verse number 23. It says, the counsel of Ahithophel, which he gave in those days, was as if one had inquired at the oracle of God, as if God himself spoke and gave you the answer to your question. So was all the counsel of Ahithophel, both with David and with Absalom. Now, David was king. David got run out of office. Absalom came in to take over. Ahithophel had advised David, and Ahithophel was now also going to advise Absalom. But when Ahithophel spoke, it was as if God answered your question himself. Chapter 17. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, David now is in retreat with his servants, let me choose 12,000 men. I'll arise and I'll pursue David tonight. I'll come upon him while he's weary and weak. I'll make him afraid, and all the people who are with him will flee, but I will strike only the king. I'll bring back all the people to you. They'll return except the man whom you seek, and then all the people will be at peace. This is good advice if you're trying to take over the kingdom. The same pleased Absalom and all the elders of Israel. Then Absalom said, well, now Hushai the Archite, let's hear him also, see what he has to say. Hushai came to Absalom. Absalom said, go ahead, tell us. This is what Ahithophel said. Shall we do as he said? If not, speak up. Hushai said to Absalom, the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good at this time. Hushai said, you know your father and his men. They're mighty men, and they are enraged in their minds, like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Your father is a man of war. He will not camp with his people. Surely by now he's hidden in some pit or in some other place, and it will be when some of them are overthrown at the first that whoever hears it will say there is a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom. And even who is valiant, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt completely. For Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who with him are valiant men. Therefore I counsel that all Israel be fully gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba like the sand that is of the sea by multitude, and that you go out in battle in person. We will come upon him in some place where he may be found. We'll fall on him as the dew falls on the ground. And of him and all the men who are with him, there will not be left so much as one. Moreover, if he's withdrawn into a city, then all of Israel will bring ropes to the city. We'll pull it down into the river. There will not be one small stone left there. So Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the counsel of Hushai, the Archite, is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. The Lord has purposed to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel to the intent that the Lord might bring that disaster on Absalom. Now, the Ahithophelian attitude is in verse 23. When Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, he arose, he went home to his house, to his city, he put his household in order, and he hanged himself, and he died, and he was buried in his father's tomb. He actually had a good idea. Nobody took it. It made him so upset that he killed himself. Went home and he hanged himself. Now let's just say it this way. Every single person in the church now has had the opportunity to be unhappy. Half of the people could be unhappy last year, and the other half, they can be unhappy this year. And what Bob Dick said is, if you really want to focus, then keep your focus on James 1 and Psalm 15 and Job 29. Because all the amendments and all of the resolutions and all the council seats in the world do not speak of, do not represent spiritual maturity. He said, let's keep those issues apart. I'll give you a scenario. What if we study the matter of the Home Office move this year, and then we find out that that was a good idea after all, and we'll move to Texas next year? Now, that would be a test. That would be a real test, would it not? You know, maybe moving the Home Office really isn't have anything to do with anything anymore than to find out what you and I are all about. Think about that. It's possible. I can't proclaim it. God didn't tell me in a dream. But, you know, maybe moving the office is more to find out where we are than to try to do the right thing. It is a thing. And there will be something done in some way. God willing, we will do it together. We will do it in one piece. Hans Zimmer. Hans probably here. I don't see where he's sitting. Across the side. Got a chance to go over and visit with him. Hans and his wife have put in a garden. It's not any old garden. It's not no chintzel garden like I've had. You know, there is no yard hardly in the back. It's garden. We walked around, and I've been over there before, and different kinds of fruit trees, different kinds of berries and plants, all different kinds of vegetables that are being prepared in the greenhouse, and some are already in the ground and some are on their way. He said if he doesn't get them quite right, his wife will come along and make sure they're the way they're supposed to be. There's medicinal plants. Well, this plant is this, and this is for that, and he shows me medicinal plants scattered around, piles of compost in various stages of preparation. I would say decay, but you know, it's the same. They built the whole back of the house on this yard. The land slopes off to one side, so they had to build up the rock and then build up the soil, truckloads of soil, and then mix it with the compost, and then they had to get it to where it would slant, slope, and drain in just the right place. It is so organized that the ladybugs have to take a number to get in the door. It's unbelievable. The intent is to bear much fruit. He said, I want to be able, effectively, to feed us and, you know, have plenty left besides. You know, they gather the rainwater that comes down off the roof into one barrel and another barrel. You got three barrels where it drains barrel by barrel. You know, I just turn the hose, you know, and I water it. No, he's got rainwater. But it's to bear much fruit. And it's specific plants. Well, this one came from Germany, and this is where we got this. I mean, it isn't just scattered seed. No, it's very specifically planted. As he said, if I don't get it in right, my wife, she'll make it, fix it behind me. Much fruit. I don't even know what you do with all that food and why you haven't shared it with me. I can't even imagine. What are we? Are we sowing? Or are we sowing in a manner that will bear much spiritual fruit? Specific fruit by specific choice. Bob Dick, again, he said output is different than results. Output means we stayed busy. Results mean we accomplished the task. You could spend your whole life in your backyard and stay very busy. And you might never grow much of anything in any way. But you could certainly fill your time. We do. He said, output is certainly different than results. It's not enough to stay busy. What are our results? We have to be careful how we sow. James chapter 3, verse number 13. James 3:13. Who is wise and understanding among you? Let him show by good conduct, not just by being busy, but by being fruitful. Let him show by good conduct that his works are done in the meekness of wisdom. I don't think anybody's ever divided anything with meekness or humility. That is simply not how things are done. If you have bitter envy and self-seeking in your hearts, then don't boast and lie against the truth. This wisdom does not descend from above. It's not spiritual fruit. It's earthly, sensual, and demonic. Where envy and self-seeking exist and confusion and every evil thing will be there. But the wisdom that is from above is pure first, then peaceable, peaceable. Blessed are the peacemakers, because they have responded according to God's will. Gentle, willing to yield, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace by those who make peace. Peacemakers. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace. It's not sown in contention. It's not sown by arguments or selfish interest. It is sown in the interest of seeking to put one another first. Hebrews 12, verse number 11. I very much appreciated the focus Mr. Dick had and the contribution that he made. I have more notes from his keynote address than from any other presentation in the conference. Hebrews 12, verse number 11. No chastening seems to be joyful for the present. Okay, chastening would imply in this case that God was correcting us because we're sons. And so he's correcting us to bear much fruit. Chastening could be, though, any grievous or serious or painful duty or circumstance, if we look at it that way. Let's just say, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present. It's grievous. Oh, you like mountain climbing? No, I hate mountain climbing. Oh, I thought you liked it. No, it's very painful. It's miserable. Why do you do it? I don't know. Nevertheless, afterward, feels good when you're done, right? Afterward, it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who've been trained by it. You know, we're trained by our trials, by our circumstances, by our chastening. It trains us. What does it train us to do? It trains us to be more careful about what we say. It trains us to be more careful about how we use our time, the way we treat each other. Boy, just go get yourself in a great big scrap and see how that trains you to try to do it different next time. Grab a dog by the ears and you will be trained, at least in that one way. So it just says that chastening actually trains us. Again, I'm not terribly convinced that the home office move has anything to do with the home office move. All I know is that everybody has had an equal opportunity to be upset. So we all get to walk through this the same way. I think the way we walk through it is probably going to be the benefit that we realize. I hope the other things are put in order as quickly as possible so that we can all begin to do one thing in one way. I hope and pray that that is true. Guy Kylo made an interesting report in his president's report. He had some opening comments and he said, well, I don't need to speak twice, so he kind of combined them together. But he reflected on our youth camps and our programs that we have run, and they're accredited by the ACA. The American Camping Association is the ACA. And they're the gold standard of how camps are measured in terms of if they measure up to what the industry would expect. And so we said, okay, we want to be measured by the ACA. So they came in, and I've seen some of the manuals. I think the manual must be this big. And I'm so grateful that they didn't give it to me. So my part of the manual was only this big, and because it just had to do with my personal activity. So when this first came up and we were checking our gear and our recording and all of the ways, and the food service had to see how their food was served and the programs were all being analyzed, and we're trying to measure these standards and quantify what we needed to do where we had any deficiency. In the ACA, there had never been a camp that scored 100% until us, until they actually measured one of our camps. And we got 100%. And you know what? We didn't just get it once. We've been able to repeat that in a number of places, in a number of ways. Because when we work together by God's grace and gift, we accomplish a lot. They had never had a perfect score. We have had a few. So he just mentioned that, you know, it is incredible indeed when we work together and when we do one thing, when we show each other mutual respect and courtesy and we stand at each other's side. Philippians chapter 2, verse number 1. Philippians 2, verse 1. If there's any consolation in Christ, any comfort in love, any fellowship of the Spirit, any affection and mercy, fulfill my joy by being like-minded. Have that same love, be of one accord, of one mind, let nothing be done through selfish ambition or vain or conceit, but in lowliness of mind, let each esteem others better than himself. If you've ever been upset with someone, if you tried praying for them, and if you noticed that when it's hard to be angry with someone you pray for diligently, it's just hard. Because prayer is an act of concern. It's hard to be upset with someone you're concerned about. It just makes it harder. But let each esteem others better than himself. Let each of you look out not only for your own interests, but also for the interests of others. And again, that's how this spiritual maturity plays out. It's how it works. Bob Dick made another comment that I thought was interesting. Again, I'm writing down. He analyzes things very, very carefully, very analytical. And I told him afterwards that I enjoyed his presentation, the points that he brought out. But he said, if we don't have doctrine right, then we don't have anything. I mean, if you don't even know when the Sabbath is or when to go before God to worship, and we don't know to obey God and to keep his laws, we don't have anything. You're just broken into the ways of this world, floating along according to whatever wind of doctrine is blowing at that moment. But then he said, but if all we have is doctrine, then we still don't have anything. Because you can show up on the Sabbath and you can send in your tithe and you can obey God, but if it's not from your heart and if it doesn't include the meekness of spirit that goes with it, you still don't have anything. Boy, that's an interesting contrast. If you don't know the truth, you don't have anything. If all you know is the truth and you don't do anything with it, you still no better off. You have to go beyond that. You have to go on to spiritual maturity. Got an email from a member yesterday. I don't know how he knew that I could use this in my sermon, but, you know, somehow or other, you know, it come floating through, and I looked at it, and I said, well, that's interesting. It's a little bit about what I'm addressing. And this is a pastor's search committee. Now, there's one I've seen some of us have had in the past, and this is newer, so at least I could share it. But they went through different people in the Bible, and they were looking for a pastor, so they commented on some of what the problems would be. Adam had problems with his wife, and they also walked around nude. Noah had a pastorate for 120 years and didn't convert a single person. Not much of an evangelist. Joseph has a prison record. Moses has a murder charge on his head. David had an affair with his neighbor's wife. Solomon was too extravagant, and besides that, he was a bigamist. Elijah collapsed under pressure. You couldn't trust Elijah. You can't depend on somebody who gives way when the pressure's on. Can't use Elijah. Hosea's wife was a prostitute. It goes through a bunch of names here. John the Baptist didn't dress very well, didn't dress up. Peter had a bad temper. He was known to curse when angry. Paul was short on tact. You know, read 1 Corinthians, you know. Timothy was too young. Judas, they thought they might consider, at least he knew how to handle money. So, I mean, they could say, well, there's something positive there. But the point is this. These are heroes of faith in many respects. Heroes in service to God. You can take anyone you want, you can pick them apart. You can pick apart their past. You can pick apart some inference or something they said. You can pick apart what you assume their motivation to be, and we must not do that. That is not spiritual maturity. I just thought, you know, I thought it's interesting. You could pick the whole system apart and everybody that's in it and ourselves as well, but it won't work. It's not spiritual maturity. It's not going to bear much fruit. We're at peace here. I hope, I expect we'll stay at peace here. And I expect to be at peace tomorrow. And hopefully to contribute to the peace of those around us as well. 1 Corinthians 6 talks about going to court outside of the church. But I would say, obviously, the central point here is, why wouldn't you rather suffer loss yourself than to do something that is going to cause trouble to someone else? That's what it's saying. That's the ultimate point. Wouldn't you rather suffer your own loss than to cause trouble for someone else? 1 Corinthians 6, verse 1. Dare any of you, having a matter against another, go to law before the unrighteous and not before the saints? Do you not know that saints will judge the world? If the world will be judged by you, are you unworthy to judge the smallest matters? Do you not know that we shall judge angels? How much more things that pertain to this life? If then you have judgments concerning things pertaining to this life, do you appoint those who are least esteemed by the church to judge? I say this to your shame. There goes that tact again, you know, no tact. Is it so that there's not a wise man among you, not even one, who'd be able to judge between his brethren? Brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers. Now, therefore, is already another failure for you that you go to law against one another. Why would you not rather accept wrong? Why don't you rather let yourselves be defrauded? Why not take the loss yourself, rather than make accusation and take someone else and cause loss to them? I'm not saying if somebody burns your house down that there isn't accountability. I'm saying the Bible clearly says that we should be willing to be defrauded if need be to maintain unity in a proper way. We should be willing to be defrauded ourselves rather than to accuse someone else. No, you yourselves do wrong and defraud, and you do these things to your brethren. Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do you realize that some of us won't even be there? The five virgins who are locked out of the wedding supper are virgins when Jesus Christ returns. They're not going to be in the kingdom of God. They were virgins and they had oil, but not much, and it didn't last. You know, maybe they worked through part of the heat of the day, but they didn't finish into the harvest. They didn't bear much fruit. In Joshua chapter 22 is just a great example, and I think it applies to us today. Joshua 22. Verse 1. Joshua called the Reubenites, the Gadites, half the tribe of Manasseh. He said, "You've kept all that Moses, the servant of the Lord, commanded you. You've obeyed my voice in all that I commanded you. You've not left your brethren these many days up to this day, but have kept the charge of the commandment of the Lord your God." You see, they wanted land on the other side of the Jordan. You remember? They said, "Give us this land. This is good land." Well, that's not what we intended. But give us this land. Okay, as long as you help your brothers fight to win their land, and then you can return and settle yours, at least for the men. "Now the Lord your God has given rest to your brethren, as he promised them. Now therefore return, go to your tents, to the land of your possession, which Moses the servant of the Lord gave you on the other side of the Jordan. But take diligent heed to do the commandment and the law which Moses the servant of the Lord commanded you, to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, keep his commandments, hold fast to him, serve him with all your heart and with all your soul." Joshua blessed them and sent them away, and they went to their tents. Now they get to go to their possession. Verse number 10. When they came to the region of the Jordan, that is the land of Canaan, the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, and half tribe of Manasseh built an altar there by the Jordan, a great and impressive altar. The children of Israel heard someone say, "Behold, the children of Reuben, children of Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh have built an altar on the frontier of the land of Canaan, in the region of the Jordan, on the side occupied by the children of Israel." When the children of Israel heard of it, the whole congregation of the children of Israel gathered together at Shiloh to go to war against them. You know what Shiloh means? Peace. So they gathered together at peace to make war against their brethren. Then the children of Israel sent Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, the priest of the to the children of Reuben, to the children of Gad, and half tribe of Manasseh, into the land of Gilead. And with him were 10 rulers, one ruler each from each chief house of every tribe of Israel. Each one was the head of the house of his father during the divisions of Israel. They came to the children and said, Reuben, Gad, Manasseh. And they said, thus says the whole congregation of the Lord, what treachery is this that you have committed against the God of Israel to turn away this day from following the Lord, in that you have built for yourselves an altar that you might rebel this day against the Lord? They're going to go to war and they're going to kill them. Verse 21. Then the children of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh said to the heads of the divisions of Israel, the Lord God of gods, he knows. Let Israel itself know. If it is in rebellion or if it's in treachery against the Lord, then do not save us this day. Go ahead and kill us if we have turned against God. If we have built ourselves an altar to turn from following the Lord, or if to offer burnt offerings or grain offerings or peace offerings on it, let the Lord himself require an account. But in fact, if we have done it for fear for a reason, saying, in time to come, your descendants may speak to our descendants, saying, what have you to do with the Lord God of Israel, because you're not on the same side of the river that we are? For the Lord has made the Jordan a border between you and us, you children of Reuben and children of Gad. You have no part in the Lord. So your descendants would make our descendants to cease fearing the Lord. It says, therefore, we said, let us prepare and build ourselves an altar, not for burnt offering, not for sacrifice, but that it may be a witness between you and us and our generations after us, that we may perform the service of the Lord before him, with our burnt offerings and sacrifices, our peace offerings, that your descendants may not say to our descendants, you have no part in the Lord. Therefore, we said that it will be, when they say this to us or our generation in the time to come, we will say, here is the replica of the altar of the Lord which our fathers made, through not for burnt offerings or sacrifice, but as a witness between you and us. Far be it from us that we should rebel against the Lord and turn from following the Lord this day to build an altar for offerings and sacrifices. Far be it from us. Verse 33. So the thing pleased the children of Israel, and the children of Israel blessed God. They spoke no more of going against them in battle to destroy the land where the children of Reuben and Gad dwelt. And the children of Reuben, the children of Gad, called the altar witness, for it is a witness between us that the Lord is God. Is that an amazing story? Somebody does something, somebody else says, that looks suspicious, I will kill you. And they go to form their armies and attack, but just in case, before they carry through, they actually stop and ask, oh, by the way, what's the altar for? Oh, it's a witness to make sure that we're always bonded together. We want to serve the God as you do and never be apart. Oh, that's okay. We won't go to war after all. I wonder how many wars have been fought in the Church of God because somebody imputed motives or made accusation or listened to rumors or spread rumors with their own lips or their own hands, because the keyboard seemed to be the medium of choice today, by assuming something that simply wasn't true. And I would say, how about us? How about us? Hosea 10, verse number 12. Sow for yourselves righteousness. Reap in mercy. Hosea 10:12. Break up your fallow ground, for it is time to seek the Lord till he comes and rains righteousness on you. The prophecy to Israel, instructions to Israel, obviously applies to us today. The conference this year was on going on to perfection. Mr. Dix said, is that a platitude? Is it a nice, noble concept or a precept, something that we must do? He asked, are we going on to perfection or are we just going on? Brethren, be careful what you do.